This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by one of the most famous people in healthcare, a brilliant leader, someone who ran AHIP for years and now serves as the CEO of Emblem Health. We've got Kiran Ignani on the podcast today. We're going to talk to Kiran about Emblem Health, top priorities, sort of what she sees in terms of sort of insurance, the current state of the world in healthcare, and more. Kiran, can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Yes, of course. First of all, Scott, thank you for all of those accolades. I think I should just stop now because I can't possibly compete with what you said. So thank you very, very much. I am here in New York City as the CEO of Emblem Health. We are a not-for-profit plan serving 3 million people across the tri-state area. And we have a number of interesting facets to our plan. Most notably, we have a 42-practice physician group associated with the plan. So your listeners know Kaiser very well. We're Kaiser without the hospital. So that distinguishes us as a health plan and a physician provider, which during the COVID crisis has given us a very, very interesting prism and real awareness about the depths of the problems that are being experienced across the country right now.
Take a moment and talk about top three priorities right now in running Emblem Health, the big three priorities.
Sure. First, we're engaged, almost finished, on the back end of a massive technological transformation. And we'll complete that this year with a range of not only 21st century technology that will put us on par with a number of our large competitors, which for a not-for-profit plan is very important, but also will give us access to support services for our customers and our providers that will also help push on our innovation agenda. The second thing that is a major priority and has been for us is to continue to be an innovator in value-based payments and customer service. And then finally, addressing disparities in care, in health access, and social determinants of care. And we've put a lot of resources behind that. The COVID crisis has actually caused us to step back and think even more broadly about that.
Let me ask you a sort of a follow-up question. So you've talked about three big priorities, a huge tech update, innovation in value-based care and constant innovation, and then third, addressing disparities in healthcare, social determinants of health, and more. And of course, in the COVID crisis, those have become clearer and clearer and been highlighted by some of the challenges
right.
In how COVID's impacted different communities. Take a moment. You run a plan with 3 million enrollees or so, which is not small, but not huge. You're competing against the massive plans, the Uniteds of the world, the Blue Crosses of the world, Aetnas and Cignas, and depending on what neighborhood you're in, one or two of them is more dominant than whatever neighborhood you're in, whatever state you're in your geographic area. You talked about customer service. What are some of the advantages? We see, again, the blossoming of some smaller plants, smaller compared to these big, big, massive behemoth plants. What are some of the advantages or strengths that a smaller plant has to access to be competitive in today's world against these massive plants?
Well, it's a great question. You have to think like a startup. And startups have a lot to teach large companies and medium-sized companies. And for us, one of the things that is really screams out when you think and look at startups is the customer care and the focus on that. And that has caused us to really invest in technological support structures that will give us a 360 view of our beneficiaries so that we will have an awareness, no matter who talks to a beneficiary, whether it's a care coordinator, a physician, a customer service associate, or anyone else, they will have an awareness of who talked to that person and when and why the time before. So that gives us an opportunity not to have a customer repeat everything that has been troubling them or concerning them, but it allows us to, with alacrity, really jump in, solve their problem, get first call resolution or first encounter resolution in with much higher probability.
And so critical, this closeness with customers is one of the advantages, closeness with providers as well, and just managing the relationships very closely is one of the advantages that a smaller mid-sized plan could have compared to the behemoth plans, and really with technology and other things doubling down on this. Let me ask you a different question. You served as the leader of AHIP, the Association of Health Insurance Plans, for a relatively long time. You were really the face behind that organization for a long time. You developed a remarkable reputation as both brilliant, smart, a pleasure of a person, and a fighter. You famously represented AHIP during the Clinton years, when the Clintons were pushing for massive changes in healthcare, and the American public wasn't really ready for it at that time. You've got this changing evolution in healthcare today, where because of big unemployment, because of health disparities, we're again seeing a push towards either Medicare for all, and it remains to be seen what happens in this fall's elections, or public options. And you've got a different part of the electorate that's interested in some of these things than you did 20 or 30 years ago. What are some of your sense of where some of these things go in the future, whether it's Medicare for all, public options, or new ways of handling healthcare finance? Any thoughts along those lines?
Yeah, I think basket of alternatives that you mentioned are all, they have something important in common. They're all strategies to solve problems. And virtually all of them have embedded in their proposal a strategy to put caps on reimbursements to providers, thereby reducing costs. We can reduce costs through the private sector as well by following similar types of strategies they're recommending in these proposals. It all depends on the willingness of government public officials to pursue that agenda. And the Axiom Healthcare that was well known 20 years ago is still very salient today, that my cost containment is someone else's revenue reduction. And that has really been a very strong barrier to actually government taking on this concept of cost of care and what strategies should be implemented. So the private sector can be a partner with government, not only in expanding access, and we've had a terrific track record in that regard, but also reducing costs. It depends on the appetite, ultimately, of public officials to pursue that agenda.
And let me ask you a follow-up question to this. What is lost in some of these discussions is, and people have different thoughts on this, but that in many areas, we have significant shortages of providers, and with a country of 330 million, that sort of gap between how many people we need to serve and how many providers we have is growing and not getting smaller, even with telehealth and people resting at the top of the license. So if you fix the issue of everybody has healthcare coverage financially, which are really what these things are about, is clarifying those coverage, you don't necessarily solve the access problem unless you either better utilize the provider force that we have or we have a lot more providers. Any thoughts on that? Because I think some of the things that are lost are, is that you really speak to this issue of, if you change how you pay for something, that dollar's coming out of somebody's pocket. And if it comes out of a provider pocket, and we don't have providers as it is, do we end up with a different problem and still have a huge access problem?
Yeah, I'm going to answer this question through the prism of our physician practice. And if our physician leader were sitting in my chair today, she would, I believe, answer in a similar way. Physicians now, and particularly primary care and specialty practices, are really on the cutting edge of looking at how do we determine what workforce and what complement of individual specialists and specialties is necessary to serve populations, particularly populations in high-risk areas. Clearly, you need physicians. Clearly, you need nurses. But then there's, a growing understanding about the role of social workers, the role of healthcare workers, as we open up the conversation, which we must have in our society, about home care and how to allow people to age in place. Healthcare workers who are not social workers, they're not nurses, but they've been trained to do a number of things, to bring information to patients, to close gaps in care, and to work with practitioners to do that. I think we're going to have we're going to enlarge our view about the healthcare workforce. And I think that often offers a real opportunity for individuals to be trained in new ways and to have new careers that will be longstanding with health benefits. And that's important for our society, particularly now as we think about all the issues and the cross currents in society. But I think that's also very important for patients. So I think the reliance on an old way of thinking about the healthcare workforce really needs now to, we need to push those boundaries. And we're doing that in our physician practice. Other physician practices are doing that. Hospitals are beginning to do that. And I think that's very encouraging as we think more expansively about what is necessary to support the health and safety of our patients in the healthcare arena today and going forward.
Thank you very much. Now, Karen, you've had this remarkable career in leadership. Anybody who's seen you over the years understands why you've been so effective and so successful. Can you give us a few tips or thoughts that you would give to emerging leaders on leadership?
Well, I first would say I don't mean to be presumptuous. Leadership is a very personal enterprise. But I would say that one of the most important things that we all learned in school, and you can say it in a number of ways, whether you say do unto others or walk in somebody else's shoes, this concept of empathy and openness, Scott, is very, very important, I think, in leaders. And we don't talk about it enough, and we don't seem as a society to expect that or insist on that in our leaders, and I think that's crucial. Two, I think it's very important to not take the air out of every room as a leader, so that listen, let others speak, let others participate. That doesn't mean that you are less strong or weak. It means that you're taking advantage of the team that you have recruited and allowing them to participate in something that they can be accountable for and own. And then finally, I really like this concept of startups. And what startups do is build strong, empowered teams. And I think leaders need to be the hardest working member of the team.
So, such a fascinating thought process. One of the things I'll pick up on for a moment, empathy and team building, so, so critical. All of us have learned nothing great gets done without a magnificent team. It just doesn't. But you talked about something that's so fascinating. When you have a leader that takes up all the air in the room, you end up in a spot where the rest of the team is not empowered. Is that the sense you have?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think that's something that really should be discussed more. Certainly, it is understood practically for people who are on the wrong end of that. But I think it's very important for leaders to have an EQ and understand how they can be precipitators, empowerers, coaches, you know, whatever words you want to use. But I think it's very important for leaders to have some understanding of the impact that they can have if they drop back a little and encourage others.
I think a brilliant thought from you. Let me ask you a different question. You're free to answer or not answer. When you served as the lead of AHIP, you famously ended up being the public face and the lightning rod of that campaign to sort of combat at that time what was deemed Hillary care or Clinton care, whatever it might be. And you did so, I assume that you were sort of asked to do so because you have a great public facing persona. You're very likable and very smart and very sharp. And at the same time, your constituents, which were some of the largest health insurance plans in the country, didn't want to be perceived in the middle of a public battle. So you ended up having to sort of take the public's face of that for better or for worse. Any thoughts on that experience? And if I captured that incorrectly?
I think every association leader represents his or her constituency. And if you don't want to represent your constituency, you shouldn't be doing that work or doing that job. I came to AHIP from the AFL-CIO, where I helped unions save their benefits by negotiating HMOs and PPOs, because the alternative was to significantly cut their benefits, massive out-of-pocket increases in costs, et cetera. So that was the prism through which I came to the role back in the 90s, the late 90s. And that always stuck with me because I felt that there was a social aspect of that for working men and women that was very important. My dad was a firefighter. And so that's the constituency that I grew up with. I knew that. That was my family. And I knew how important it was for them to have healthcare coverage. So I think our health plans have had a long track record of delivering high quality, affordable healthcare. And to be part of to have been a part of that was a real pleasure. I also worked in the context or with the Obama administration on the access to care legislation. And we made, as a society, so much progress in taking a leap, bringing so many people into the system. And recent events have carved that back, made it more difficult. I think we have to go back to those fundamental precepts to make sure that people are not left out of the system. I think health plans have a role in that. I think hospitals have a role in that. I think members of Congress and leaders in the government have a role in that. And I think it's a something that should be important to both Democrats and Republicans.
I have to say, you are truly a remarkable leader. It's so exciting for me to see you in this role now of serving as CEO of a health plan directly. You've had this remarkable, truly wonderful career. You're a wonderful leader, and it's a real privilege to get a chance to talk to Karen Ignani today. Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.